Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole, in for Tim Bruno. Thank you so much for being here with me this morning. Coming up on today's show, Pennsylvania's mail-in voting rules just got a major shakeup. A new ruling from their Supreme Court strengthens protections for mail-in voters. If your ballot has a mistake, like a wrong date or missing signature, you have the right to be notified before it's rejected. Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA is coming right up. And our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, has stories that caught his eye, including a comet blazing through the sky and an ancient toolkit from our Stone Age ancestors. Then it's disco, danger, and detective work. Murder on the Dance Floor, Disco Inferno's a one-night-only interactive whodunit at NACL. All of that and more coming right up, right after this news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Stocks on Wall Street opened lower this morning as many functions of the federal government grind to a halt. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 100 points in early trading.
Historically, government shutdowns have caused limited fallout for the broader economy. Forecasters at Deutsche Bank estimate that if the shutdown drags on, it could shave about 0.2% off GDP for each week the government remains shuttered. One casualty of the shutdown is the September jobs report, which was supposed to be released on Friday. That report, and possibly others, will be delayed until the government reopens. That leaves business people and policymakers guessing as to whether the summer slowdown in job growth continued into the fall. In other business news, Walmart says it plans to phase out artificial dyes and other food additives from its U.S. store brands by January of 2027. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Turning Point USA returned to Utah last night, only weeks after Charlie Kirk, the organization's founder, was shot and killed in the state. Martha Harris of member station KUER reports it was the latest stop of campus tours across the country.
The event was at Utah State University. After Kirk's shooting, Utah Governor Spencer Cox has gotten national praise for his response. But in this crowd, as alma mater, Cox was booed as soon as he stepped on stage. In 2022, Kirk had called for Cox to be expelled from the Republican Party. This was after Cox said he would veto a bill about transgender people. Cox told the crowd he agreed with Kirk on 99% of things, and he again called for people to talk with those they don't agree with. For NPR News, I'm Martha Harris in Logan.
Hamas and other armed groups in Gaza are weighing a plan from President Trump that could end the war in Gaza. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports scores of people continue to be killed daily by Israeli bombardment.
Hospitals in Gaza say among the dozens of Palestinians killed in the past 24 hours by Israeli fire were 20 people, among them teenagers, trying to access food aid from an American-run site in central Gaza. Several of those killed were brothers. Another attack in Gaza City killed a rescue worker and wounded six other first responders. Gaza civil defense say the crew was struck as they were rescuing people from an Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced families. Israel's military says it's targeting Hamas fighters and infrastructure across Gaza. The military says Palestinians can no longer return to Gaza City from the south, where hundreds of thousands of people have been forcibly displaced this month. The single road out of the city is now open only to those leaving. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Stocks continue to trade lower on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was down 82 points. The Nasdaq Composite down 81. The S&P 500 also trading lower, down 19. This is NPR News. Tesla is hiking lease prices on all of its vehicles in the United States. The move comes after a $7,500 federal tax credit for electric vehicles expired. That credit helped make EVs more affordable, but new rules passed by Congress have wiped out incentives for leasing or buying many new electric models. Used electric vehicles also lost their credit on Tuesday. It's the latest shakeup for consumers trying to go electric. Alaska's Fat Bear Week has a new champion, and his name is Chunk. Alaska Public Media's Ava White has more about the massive bear who beat the odds to pack on the pounds.
It's the first time Chunk has been dubbed the fattest bear in Katmai National Park and Preserve. He has dark brown fur, a scar across his muzzle, and, most notably, a broken jaw that staff say will never fully heal. Katmai Park Ranger Sarah Bruce says staff didn't know if he'd still be able to feast on salmon, but he persevered and ate so much he now weighs over 1,200 pounds.
I think he just has really great stories to tell, and I think folks really cling on to what they can learn from the bears through their resilience, through their perseverance, and their boldness.
His victory was declared after he triumphed in a matchup after matchup in a bracket that drew a record number of voters from around the world, according to the National Park Service. For NPR News, I'm Ava White in Anchorage.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 68 points, the Nasdaq down 79. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole, sitting in for Tim Bruno. Well, we've got just 33 days to go until the November election, and in Pennsylvania, there's been a major ruling regarding mail-in ballots. On Friday, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled voters must be notified if election officials are going to reject their mail ballots because of an error, such as an incorrect date or missing signature on their return envelope. In a 4-3 decision, the court ruled that Washington County erred in not notifying 2024 presidential primary voters that their mail ballots would be rejected, leaving them unaware that their votes would go uncounted. The decision, in combination with another ruling last year from the High Court, means that voters across the state will have at least some rights to be notified and have some recourse if their mail ballots are at risk of being rejected because of basic mistakes. Tim Bruno spoke with Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA for more details.
Back in the 2024 primary, those many months ago, Washington County in the eastern part of the state hadn't notified some voters that there were disqualifying errors with their mail ballots. And what the Supreme Court said was that that violated the voters' due process rights to challenge that decision by the county or to go try and cast a provisional ballot at their polling place on election day, because obviously if the voters don't know that there was an issue, then they can't challenge it.
Beyond due process, were there other legal principles the court cited in its 4-3 decision, particularly in Justice Kevin Doherty's majority opinion?
Right. Well, one of the other things that they said was that the notifications count the county was sending out to the voters was misleading. When a mail ballot gets returned to a county, there's several options in the computer system that they use to track those ballots that the county can select. And given, depending on which option the county selects, it generates different emails. The option that the county was using would just tell the voters that their ballot had been received. But there are more specific codes that the county could have used that would say that the ballot had been received, but there was a problem with it, like it was missing its secrecy envelope or something like that. And the court said that because the county wasn't using those more specific codes, even though they knew there was an issue with the ballot, that they were misleading the voters.
So they made these specific errors, and that was unnoticed by voters, basically.
Right. The voters had no way of knowing that they had made a disqualifying error.
What challenges do voters face when they're unaware of errors on their mail ballots, and how does this ruling address those challenges?
Well, when they're unaware that they've even made an error, I mean, options are pretty limited. If they don't know that they have a problem, then they can't really do anything to fix it. When they are aware, though, depending on where they might live, you know, some counties will allow them to come into the county elections office and fix the error with a ballot. Maybe that's, you know, filling in the date or their signature that they forgot on the return envelope. But this ruling, what's interesting about it is the system that it now, you know, de facto sets up for every single county. You might recall there was another decision last year just before the presidential election, which in which the court ruled that if a voter has a fatal error on their mail ballot, like they forgot a date or a signature, and they go to their polling place and cast a provisional ballot, then the county has to count that provisional ballot if there's, you know, no other reason that it shouldn't be counted. So these two decisions combined set up a system that we've talked a lot about before, which is notice and cure. Now in all counties, voters should get some notice that their ballot has a fatal error, and they'll have at least that provisional voting option to cure that error.
So this decision will help standardize practices across the state?
Yes, just a little bit, because there's still a wide variety of what notice and cure means across the state. Like I said, some counties, they'll just resend you an entirely new ballot package, envelope, ballot, and everything, and cancel the first one. Other counties are, you know, they just do this. They'll accept the provisional if you go to your polling place. So still a pretty wide variety, but at least some options for voters to fix errors in all counties.
How might this ruling influence voter turnout and confidence in upcoming elections?
Well, I think those are two separate issues, obviously. I think as far as turnout goes, you know, we have seen that when voters have the ability to fix errors, you know, it obviously does lead to more ballots being counted. So probably will increase turnout a little bit. Might be hard to tell in this year, an off-year election, so to speak. The other question on voter confidence, I think that's a little bit of a mixed bag. You know, I certainly heard from some election officials, and I've heard from them over the years, that they don't appreciate, and they don't think voters appreciate either, what feels like a back and forth from the courts, and then that can actually undermine confidence. There was another case in 2020 that dealt with this question of notice and cure for ballots, you know, if voters should be informed and given a chance to fix errors. That was brought by the state Democratic Party. And in that case, the court had ruled that, you know, there's nothing in the law and there's nothing in our state constitution that requires us to tell counties you have to do notice and cure. And this was something one of the judges in the dissenting side of this case last week pointed out. He said, hey, you know, in 2020, we ruled that there is no requirement for notice and cure, but now through a combination of these two cases, we've created notice and cure, so we're kind of going back on what we said just 5 years ago. So in that regard, that could actually end up undermining voter confidence if, you know, if they take that view that the court is flip-flopping.
And always different outcomes when it comes to election laws in Pennsylvania. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about that, these legal precedents. Do you think this decision sets a new legal precedent for how election laws should be interpreted in Pennsylvania? I mean, it is a major ruling on mail-in ballots.
Yeah, well, I mean, it certainly sets precedent. Now, this is the state Supreme Court, so, you know, what they say supposedly goes. But as the dissenting judge points out, since somebody raised a new legal theory by which notice and cure should be required under the state constitution that wasn't brought up 5 years ago, so the court effectively reversed its thinking. And I bring that up to say, you know, it's hard to know. Maybe this is what the law of the land is right now, but perhaps there's another legal theory out there that somebody else brings up that changes that. I'd be reticent to ever say that any issue on election law is ever fully settled, unfortunately, because it just seems to be the way it goes. These things get repeatedly litigated.
Especially in Pennsylvania. Are there anticipated legal challenges or appeals to this ruling, and what might they entail?
Not yet. Not that I've seen. Really, once an issue reaches the state Supreme Court, you know, that legal theory of the case is pretty much settled. Unless one of the parties were to appeal to the United States Supreme Court, there's a very narrow path that litigants can take and ask the United States Supreme Court to take up a case by basically saying, hey, the state Supreme Court overstepped its bounds here and stepped into the role of the legislature. That's always available in any election law case. You know, I guess we'll have to see if they use that here. Of course, they still have a while to appeal this ruling, 30 or 45 days if they would want to go to the state Supreme Court. The other option, I suppose, would be to come up with a new legal theory, and, you know, who's to say if and when that happens.
Have you heard from public officials, election officials, or voters? What's been the reaction?
I think a little bit muted. Everybody, I think, has seen a lot of these decisions come and go, so I was surprised that my inbox actually didn't fill up with as many statements on this case as other cases have generated in the past. I did hear from a couple of voters, though, who were happy with the decision, that, you know, that they'll know if they made a mistake now. I think that was appealing to them, but obviously then there's still the criticism of the court.
Your beat is elections, vote beat. As a reporter covering this case, are there any aspects of the ruling you found most surprising or significant?
Yeah, I thought the most significant part is just the system that it sets up. We had pre-written a story about this decision, you know, a version of the story that yes, they upheld it, or no, they knocked it down from last year, because if it had come before the presidential election, it would have drastically changed our system, because now every voter will know if they make an error and have an option to fix it. That wasn't the case before. It was just some voters had that option, but now it's every single voter. And so that does bring a little bit more uniformity. So, and that was the main thing that we were watching for with this case, is are they going to rule these two in conjunction to set up that system, or is it going to be one ruling towards a notice and cure and one ruling away from notice and cure? But they ended up both going towards that type of a system.
That's Carter Walker, a reporter for VoteBeat in partnership with Spotlight PA. You can read his reporting at votebeat.org or spotlightpa.org. Carter, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you, Tim. What's happening right now in New York political news is New York Governor Kathy Hochul is rallying with New Yorkers to call out what she calls, quote, Washington Republicans' reckless government shutdown in New York City, end quote. And she's actually speaking live in New York City right now. Let's just go to that for one moment here.
Pick up that torch. We'll hold it high. Make sure it shines brightly as a symbol of the compassion and the fairness and opportunity that have always been represented by this incredible symbol. This is personal to us. The Statue of Liberty stands in our harbor, and that fact alone defines our destiny to protect her and all she stands for. We have a moral duty to guard her legacy and everything she symbolizes, and in so doing, we'll create our own legacy as defenders, protectors, and fighters. Are you ready for this fight?
We are.
Yes. Yes. I'm ready for this fight.
Okay, that's New York Governor Kathy Hochul speaking live about the government shutdown. She's actually with the gathered folks in front of Liberty Island. You can see Liberty Island with Statue of Liberty just behind her. And earlier she was referring to the Statue of Liberty and the government shutdown, saying we don't know if that torch is actually going to be lit tonight. So Governor making some noise today about the government shutdown down in New York City. We're going to go back to our program here with more local news. It's time for science stories with our resident science guy, Joe Johnson. Today, Joe has a big update on a comet streaking through our skies. It might just be visible to the naked eye by the end of the month, fingers crossed. And breakthrough hydrogel technology that could change the way we grow our food. But what's the first story that you have for us today, Joe?
So we've got three stories to bring you this week. The first is about a toolkit, a Paleolithic toolkit. Now, this is from the August 13th issue of the Journal of Paleolithic Archaeology. It's about an archaeological site in the Czech Republic known as Milovica 4. There's a whole bunch of Paleolithic archaeological sites in the area. Now, this was discovered in 2009 during some road construction. Apparently, part of the road collapsed, and they discovered a bunch of abandoned cellars. They brought in the archaeologists, and they found that below these old cellars, there was even older deposits. And they've been excavating them ever since, working downwards through different layers, different horizons. Now, the layer that we're going to talk about here was dated through carbon 14 of some charcoal from a campfire, and it dates to about 30,000 years old, which puts it in the upper Paleolithic, in other words, the last days of the old Stone Age. Let me set the scene. This was, Europe was, you know, still in the last ice age. North America was as well. When our ancestors at the time were hunter-gatherers, they were hunting and gathering wild foods. Agriculture, as we know, it was probably about 20,000 years in the future at this point. Now, this culture has been named the Gravettian by archaeologists, and it's famous for their carved effigies of women that they call the Venus figures. You can find pictures of them online. They're really kind of cool. The site was probably a hunting camp. They found remains of wild horses and reindeer. It was an open-air site, and I think it was not a home base, because the home base for these people were usually caves. So in 2021, they discovered this toolkit, which was made up of 29 blades and bladelets, they call them. Now, they were all found together. Normally, when they find tools, they'll find one here, one there. These were all together in a group, and it looked like it had been wrapped in some kind of skin. And the skin, of course, is, you know, long skin, animal skin, has long since decayed away and just left the tools. There were spear points that were meant to be hafted onto a spear shaft, cutting and scraping implements for, you know, butchering animals and processing animal skins, drills. There were even blanks that they could make future tools out of. So the people were kind of looking to the future. Some of them showed signs of wear from usage, and some showed that they had actually been retouched. In other words, they go back through and they snap the blade off. The stones were made of flint, chert, and even one was made from opal. And they're a microcrystalline silicate material that chips off in little tiny sharp flakes. And so they could see where they had actually even been resharpened, retouched. The sources of them, this is what I thought was cool, were 50 to 80 miles away, because they can find out where, you know, where the rock comes from, where did this deposit come from. So that to me is pretty cool that these people were traveling that far in those days. They were, you know, probably nomadic hunter-gatherers and just living by their wits.
And, you know, when you talk about the Paleolithic, especially like the early Stone Age, even if it's a later part of the early Stone Age, I mean, 30,000 years ago, it's prehistory. There's little first-hand type of information. So anything we can find tells us so much. But the fact that these things were found together and likely from one person, and that connects us to an individual, gives us some insight into what an individual's life may have been like 30,000 years ago. That's a phenomenal thing.
Yeah, it's a little piece of the puzzle. You know, we've got all these pieces, and we, you know, try to piece together exactly what their lives were like.
Okay, next up, hydrogel.
Yeah, hydrogels.
Used for a lot of stuff, but now maybe farming?
This is an article from the June 19th issue of the American Chemical Society's Agricultural Science and Technology Journal. And it's all about a newly developed hydrogel, which has some, as you said, some promising uses in agriculture. Now, first of all, what is a hydrogel? Well, a hydrogel is a 3D network of natural or synthetic polymers, you know, repeating units, capable of absorbing and retaining large amounts of water. It's what we call a hydrophilic substance. Now, common examples that people are going to be used to, the absorbent material in disposable diapers. That's a chemical called sodium polyacrylate. That's a synthetic polymer. It's also the stuff that's in Orbeez. I don't know if you know what Orbeez are.
No.
So Orbeez are these little hard, they're like little beads, and when they're really hard. When you soak them in water, they grow to much larger sizes. A lot of kids play with them. They use them in floral displays
Okay. So I think I've seen these, but okay. I didn't know that's what they were called.
Yeah, it's a brand name.
Orbeez. Now we know.
Soft contact lenses are even hydrogels. And probably the most common example people are going to know, Jell-O. Is a hydrogel. It's a hydrogel made with gelatin. It's a natural hydrogel. Now, this hydrogel was developed by the Italian Institute of Technology in Genoa, and it's made from carrageenan. Carrageenan comes from red algae. It's a natural product. It's usually used as a thickening agent in milkshakes and ice creams. I happen to know that McDonald's uses carrageenan to thicken up their milkshakes and their soft serve ice cream. It's really porous stuff. It really absorbs and retains water really, really well. Now, the The stuff that they've developed here is going to be used, they think, in hydroponic systems. You know, hydroponic systems are pretty water intensive. And when you have a drought prone area, water is certainly, you know, not in a lot of abundance. So they'll be able to use these for hydroponic systems that are going to use a lot less water. And the cool thing about it is not only does it provide a substrate for the plants to grow on, but it actually helps the plants to grow. It acts as what's called a biostimulant. It enhances plant processes without the use of fertilizer. It helps them, you know, to ward off, diseases and things like that. Helps them to grow better. It supports them very, very well. This could also be added to soil to help the soil retain water. If you've got water, you know, soil that, you know, doesn't have a lot of organic material in it, you could actually add this stuff to it and it would absorb water. It's 100% biodegradable. It's sustainable because it's, you know, grown in the ocean. We can harvest it from the ocean. Now, future versions are going to have some kind of biodegradable sensors. The article was not real clear on this, but that'll actually like change color to monitor the plant health. And so they'll be able to just look at the stuff it's growing on and tell, okay, is this plant doing okay? I thought that was kind of cool.
Wow. So what are the next steps for this? Is this like ready to go out on the market?
You know, it did. I don't think it. They've tried it with this thing called, it's an Italian watercress, and it grew really, really well. It's a test species they use for a lot of things in science. But it grew really well. It adapted really well to the hydrogel. Now, my thought is, what about space exploration and colonization? You know, when we go to Mars, we're going to have to grow food there. The problem with Martian soil is that it's basically poisonous. It has a lot of perchlorates in it, which is this chlorine-bearing material that would really, if you were to eat a lot of it, would really mess up your thyroid. And so this might be something that they might be looking at for space exploration.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, this is the big one. You're often letting us know what's happening in the night sky.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always wondering, are there any comets on the way?
There are. There's a couple right now. Probably the best one was discovered last January. And it actually, it's really, really difficult to see right now. You'd need a telescope or some binoculars. But it may become naked eye visible by the end of October. It's called Comet C2025A6 Lemon. And the Lemon comes from the Lemon Observatory in Arizona, which is found on Mount Lemon. It's run through the University of Arizona. They do a big sky survey where they're looking for things like this. They've discovered a number of asteroids and a number of comets. Right now, it's in the northern sky in the morning. It's visible through binoculars or a really small telescope, but it's really hard to spot. It's this kind of fuzzy greenish blob. And I wondered why comets were green. So I did a little chemistry here, little research. In comets, there's a gas called dicarbon gas. And what happens is when it gets hit with really hard ultraviolet rays, it fluoresces. In other words, it excites its electrons. The electrons jump up to a higher level. And then as they fall back, they have to give up energy and they give it up in the form of a photon of green, in the green part of the spectrum. So that's why comets are green. I never knew that. I had to look that up. Now, early calculations predicted nothing impressive from the comet. It didn't look like it was going to get crazy. It went behind the sun from our perspective here on Earth on July 2nd, but it emerged on the other side way brighter than was predicted. It was predicted to be a plus 10 magnitude, which is pretty dim, not visible to the naked eye. You need a pretty good telescope to see it. But it emerged much brighter, and it's currently plus 7 magnitude, which means, you know, binoculars and a small telescope, you might be able to see it. Predicted to get up to at least plus 4 or plus 5, which is way visible into the, you know, naked eye astronomy.
Okay, this is big news, and I just want to clarify for folks, because the last time we spoke was about the 3I Atlas, which mm-hmm. the first couple times we talked about it was an object, but then it started outgassing, so we said, like, okay, that's a comet now, and you said, yes, it was, but what you're talking about now, this is different than the object that we had been talking about.
Right, 3I Atlas, you know, the I stands for interstellar, but this is a homegrown comet. This is probably from either the Kuiper Belt or the Oort cloud. The size of it probably from the Kuiper Belt, and in fact, given its orbital period. Orbital period, by the way, about 1,350 years. However, they're saying that because it went so close to Jupiter, it actually changed its trajectory, and it may, in fact, change its orbital period. So it might be a little bit shorter. It might come back in, say, 1,100 years. I won't be around to see it. I don't think you will either. But
all right. Then I won't hold you to it.
Okay. Now, if this continues, the one we're talking about here, the Lemon Comet, if it continues to brighten, it could be visible to the naked eye sometime near the end of October. Now, a couple of dates to keep in mind. On the 20th of October, it's going to be closest to the Earth. It's going to be at perigee at about 55 million miles from the Earth. And on November 8th, it'll be at perihelion. And in other words, it's closest to the sun. And those are two really good dates to observe it on. And it'll only be, by the way, for about 50 million miles from the sun. Now, if you want to see this comet, you're going to have to, first of all, you're going to have to pick your area carefully. You're going to find, it's going to be up in the sky after sunset. So about an hour after sunset, you're going to look to the northwest. It'll be pretty low on the horizon. So like I said, you have to choose your viewing spot with a good unobstructed view of the northwest. If you could get like to the southeast shore of a lake or something like that, or you can, you know, do a little research and figure out where you want to watch this from. Take about 20 minutes to let your eyes adjust to the dark. And I would, you know, and I've said this over and over, get yourself an astronomy app on your phone, especially one that presents in red so that it won't, you know, affect your night vision. I have one, it's called Sky, S-K-E-Y-E, on my Android phone. I think there's one comparable to it for the iPhone. Take about 20 minutes, let your eyes adjust to the dark. And another tip is to use your phone camera. It's actually more sensitive to than your eye. About a year ago in October, we had the 2023 Tsuchin-Chan Atlas comet that I was able to find first on my phone. And then once I had located it in the sky, I could see it with my naked eye.
You mentioned October 20th there. I just checked the moon phase calendar real quick, and that's the darkest week of the month as far as the moon's concerned. Mm-hmm. That's when the new moon hits on the 21st, 22nd. So that's some pretty good timing. Yeah. That's a good time to have a comet get close.
Yeah, it'll be great. Fingers crossed. You know, the thing about comets is they never do what's predicted. You know, this thing came out.
Right. You never know until it's there.
Exactly. It came out from behind the sun a lot brighter than we thought it was. And so more observations and updates to come. I'll keep our listeners updated as you know, more information becomes available.
Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about these stories.
Good to talk to you, too.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Lindsay Anderson and Ben Lewis will tell us about Murder on the Dance Floor, Disco Inferno at NACL this Saturday. Stay with us. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com, and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Janice Adams. Starting Monday, October 6th, join me on my new day and new time, Monday evenings at 8, for the Janice Adams Show. Crucial conversations about race, every race, and courage. The courage to listen, to speak up, to make a way out of no way. The Janice Adams Show, Monday nights at 8, starting October 6th on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole. Well, get ready to boogie and maybe solve a murder, too. Who knows? Joining us now live in the studio is Lindsay Anderson, who stars as B.B. Boogie Downs, and Ben Lewis, who stars as Dante Delmonico in Murder on the Dance Floor, Disco Inferno. And this is a one-night-only interactive disco whodunit at NACL. It's happening on Saturday. Audience members will hit the dance floor, follow the twists, and help point the finger at the killer, hopefully. Lindsay and Ben, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So let's start off. So, you know, Ben, a murder mystery set at a disco dance contest in the Catskill Mountains. Where'd this wild idea come from?
Well, it came from the idea of our theater company, and we like to have sort of a
wanted a show that was a play and a party and a experience for people to have. So it was a very eclectic group of things that got thrown into a blender, and we're sort of like the Muppets. We like to do just kind of wild and fun things. So it's an opportunity for people to come and have a party and have a dance and have a great experience, and also see a little comedy, a little drama, a little romance, something for everyone.
We got to this place because we said, we're just going to say yes to every single idea that everybody has. And when you do that, you come up with a murder mystery disco dance party.
I wanted to ask about, I mean, this is like an original work. This is something you folks workshopped yourselves. You just want to talk a little bit about that process?
Yeah, we're Bread Arts Collective. We've been together officially for over 10 years, but we've been almost 15 years of making plays together. So we've really gotten good at devising together, and we're all best friends and we deeply care about each other. And I think that's something that people can really tell when they come to a Bread show. They can really see that this is a group of people that really cares about each other.
And I know NACL functions not just as a performance space, but also as like an artist retreat. Did you work on this at NACL, or is this something that you were already working on and then you brought it to NACL?
Yeah, we a couple months ago, we started to work on it and kind of outline what we wanted to do. I am on staff at NACL, so I have the lucky fortune of living in Sullivan County while also having this theater company. So it's a really great opportunity not only to highlight NACL, but to highlight Bread Arts Collective.
So let's talk about your characters. Ben, can you tell me about Dante Delmonico?
Well, Dante Delmonico is a washed up former nightclub owner from New York City who is on the run from several different groups of people and has decided to restart his life here in Sullivan County to bring his party flair to the Catskills. And he's trucked with him a wide variety of characters. And his attempt is to sort of bring the disco dream to the Catskills and put on the greatest show that anyone's ever seen. But there's some machinations behind the scene that are maybe working against Dante and his dream for disco party heaven.
And now, Lindsay, how about you introduce us to BB Boogie Downs? Where does she fit into this murder mystery dance competition?
BB's on a journey of revenge, really. Not only is she a disco dance champion, but she's also a karate master. So she has her own motivations for not only competing at this particular dance competition, but she's got a little bit of a score to settle with somebody who may or may not have a score to settle with her as well.
So how many characters are in the cast?
Oh, gosh. Eight?
Eight. I think we have, yes, eight. And every character is just as ridiculous as the two characters
that
we've
just described. This is like Scooby-Doo.
Right. And are they all as suspicious in good murder mystery fashion?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Everybody's got their own motivation.
Everyone's a suspect.
So it's going to take the audience to help decide who done it.
So, you know, along those lines, then, you know, the audience is participating in this, trying to help solve the mystery. How do you guide them through that process without giving away who the murderer is?
Yeah, well, we've sort of we've constructed the show in such a way that it is part dance party and part play. So the audience is going to come and get a drink, get some refreshments, have fun. And then we've sort of built into this dance competition several devices where we kind of step aside and learn a little bit more about the characters. And we'll be sort of dropping hints and clues throughout the evening. And at the end, it will be up to the community of Sullivan County to determine who has done it.
And are there any stakes or any consequences? Because there's still going to be a party no matter how they figure this out, right?
Still going to be a party. The stakes might be internal. I think for the most part, just come and have a whole lot of fun.
Stakes are purely narrative. So this plays into what we had already talked about, the fact that, like, you know, you're with Bread working on this at NACL, but I didn't realize that this sort of partnership has a term, HYPE, which is hybrid performance event.
Yes.
And this is the second HYPE event of 2025. How do these events reflect NACL's approach to immersive, multifaceted performance.
Absolutely. We just want to bring as many different art forms together as possible to have these hybrid performance events. It's something we've been doing for a few years now, and it's very important to the mission of NACL is to be able to bring these different forms together and create events where people feel very welcome to come and experience the whole gambit of what we have to offer.
It seems like there's like a real tradition at NACL of theater that crosses boundaries, mm-hmm. that and blurs lines of distinctions of genre and other Absolutely. Preconceptions that people might be bringing to a theater experience. Like what mm-hmm. what is that everybody that kind of interacts at NACL is like is on that path? What is that magic ingredient?
We say it's a haven for artists to come. So I think it's a bit of a people just can pick up on the energy at NACL, and they know the culture of inclusivity. And, you know, we're just there to again, bring as many people together as possible to share their art. And Bread's been coming for nearly a decade to NACL now. So we're one of the success stories of what NACL can do for a theater company and the amount of support that they can offer theater makers to make them feel like they can come together, especially in these times.
What do you hope that attendees take away from these hype experiences beyond just the entertainment?
I think a feeling of community. I think we're all desperately after that right now. NACL is a safe space that you can go. You can meet like-minded individuals and maybe a few individuals that think differently than you, and all are welcome and all are there to really celebrate the art of performance.
If somebody hasn't been to a show like this before or one of these hype events before, anything that they need to know beforehand, anything they need to do to prepare?
I say for this one in particular, come early, get your disco swag, you know, come dressed up, you know, come in your best 70s disco outfit.
Yeah, you're encouraging folks to dress
Absolutely.
Up, right?
Okay, so it is a disco dance party.
Absolutely.
So any costume or attire tips for styles that fit the theme, anything you want to suggest to folks?
You know, I think if you got that disco look, if you got that funky little thing in the back that you're looking for a place to take it out and show it around, this is the place for it. We're going to have a little things that at the space that you can sort of accoutrement yourself. And also, if you don't want to do that, this is going to be something you can determine your own level of participation.
Yes,
in this event.
Choose your own adventure.
So if you want to come and be a star and take up all the spotlight, we are welcome to embrace you. If you want to be a little wallflower, you're going to have the most fun being a wallflower you've ever had.
No, nobody's going to force you into it, you know.
No, absolutely. We hope our energy will be infectious enough that you will just have to get up and dance.
And it often is. So,
okay, I guess my tip will be if you don't have a closet that goes back far enough that you've got something sitting in there for 45 years that you can dig out, find somebody who does. Find somebody who's got a closet where they put some stuff in there 45
absolutely.
Years ago and
Come
haven't
and just,
touched it.
Yeah. Whatever you feel like you can boogie down in.
Okay. And now speaking of boogie down, I mean, how do you have a disco dance party? You need music. You want to talk a little bit about the music selection process for this? Or where's the music coming from?
Well, one of our company members is a brilliant singer-songwriter, sound designer, and he's coming up from Auburn where he's a professor, and he's going to be creating a soundscape for us all. And, you know, in addition to that, we're going to have those standard disco hits that everybody knows and loves.
There will be needle drops. You will get your 70s needle drop fix.
You'll get your fix for sure.
Okay, great. And it's great to hear that it's not, you know, it's not just like a pre-made like tape or something. Like everybody's got skill that they're putting in. There has to be like a hands-on creative element to what you
bespoke
folks create.
Disco.
Yeah, a bespoke disco experience. And just want to remind folks, like, you know, just the details, when this is happening and the timing and all that.
October 4th, this coming Saturday. Doors are at 7. The performance is going to start around 7:30. It's $20 ahead of time, $25 at the door. Come on down.
Info's up at NACL.org. That's NACL.org. Anything else that you want folks to know before we go that we didn't get to?
Just come on out. We're really grateful for you. You're going to have a great time.
It's going to be a blast.
Okay, once again, we are talking to Lindsay Anderson, who stars as BB Boogie Downs. Thank you, Lindsay. And talking to Ben Lewis, who stars as Dante Delmonico. Thank you, Ben. And performance is Murder on the Dance Floor, Disco Inferno. One night only. It's happening a Saturday night at NACL Theater. Thank you so much for both of you for being here.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
We're going to pause for a moment. We do have more news because when we come back, Bram Stoker's Dracula is back in Rosendale this weekend. Valerie Mansi has a scoop on the fantastic production that's coming up next. This is Radio Chatskill. Hey there, Jason Dole here asking you to help Radio Catskill kick off our fall fun drive in person at the Double Down on Radio Catskill event. It's going to be a lot of fun next Sunday afternoon at the Arnold House in Livingston Manor. Free admission, fun games for kids and adults, tunes by DJ Tikka Masala, delicious hors d'oeuvres, cash bar, and your chance to win great prizes from local businesses. Don't miss Double Down on Radio Catskill Sunday, October 12th, 2 to 5 at the Arnold House.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, reminding you to join me and my friends for Laura Flanders and Friends on Radio Catskill Monday evenings at 7, followed by Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. And then, starting October 6th, we welcome the Janice Adams Show to its new night at 8, followed by La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore. Four powerhouse shows back-to-back, local voices bringing world-class conversations about what's really happening in our lives. Monday evenings on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me this morning. I'm filling in for Tim Bruno. Well, today it's October 1st, so you're going to be hearing some more and more spooky stuff as this month progresses. That's how Octobers usually go. And this October, Theater on the Road is sinking its teeth into Bram Stoker's Dracula like never before. Set in 1920s England, the classic Bram Stoker tale comes alive with Jonathan Harker, the doomed Lucy, the sinister Renfield, and the ever-dangerous Count Dracula himself. Culture reporter Valerie Mansi sat down with actor and producing artistic director Michelle Caffell-Clinton for more details on Dracula.
Welcome, Michelle Caffell-Citron, to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning, Valerie. Thank you for having me.
You are the producing artistic director of Theater on the Road out of Rosendale.
Yes, I am.
How long have you been in that position?
Well, this is a fairly new development from about January of this year. So Frank Marquette, who created the company 27 years ago with his wife, Kristen, has been doing Theater on the Road productions for, like I said, for the last 27 years, and Frank has decided to pass the torch. And so I've been working with him for the past 3 or so years, and he's asked me to help carry this on into the next generation.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful organization.
It is. It has a lot of history and some incredible productions under their belt. And I'm eager to keep building the legacy and taking it in some new directions too.
And one of the wonderful features about it is you travel throughout the Hudson Valley.
Yes. And beyond.
And now you are launching your annual Dracula production.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the annual part.
Well, this is the fifth year that Theater on the Road has produced a production of Dracula throughout the Hudson Valley. It's the fourth year with this particular script, which is the original approved version of the Bram Stoker novel. And it's actually the third year of my involvement. So there's a lot of really interesting developments that have happened over the last 5 years, and it has become the flagship production for the company.
And how has it changed over the years?
Well, we have had a number of actors who have come and gone and reappeared in different, playing different characters in the script, in the roles. And our staging always is always fresh and new. And each year we sort of build on what we learned from the last and brought on some really incredible local, regional talent that everyone is eager to tell this tale. It's a very universal story not just the vampire myth itself, but of course, all of the themes that encompass it.
And this year's production is unique in a few ways, correct?
Indeed, yes. We have expanded our venue reach further throughout the Hudson Valley and the Delaware Valley in Milford, Pennsylvania. And we're incorporating a bit of music this year. It's not a musical per se, but certainly has musical elements that heighten and elevate the themes of the piece. And have decided to cast some of the roles in non-traditional gender roles. So our Renfield this year will be played by a fabulous performer named Marissa Gorslein, who's a friend and a colleague from here in the community. And that role is traditionally played by a man. But this year I saw her audition and I thought, this is, it's a no-brainer. This fits just fluidly. And similarly, the role of Van Helsing, traditionally played by a man, is played by a woman. And in fact, I am playing Van Helsing this year again.
Well, what fun for you.
It is fun. There's a, yes, indeed.
Tell us about it. It must be quite a challenge.
Oh, for sure. Yes, absolutely. Since I have played it a few years, so, you know, I did bank a little bit on not having to memorize the lines this year while also juggling the direction. But, you know, as with any production, it's always fresh and new, especially when you're working with new faces and new personalities. But I seem to have assembled, with God's grace, an incredible team of collaborators and actors who are so creative, compassionate, resilient, and have really been inspiring this entire journey. So we're I'm happy that this is, even amidst the challenges, we have an incredible show that we want to show and share with the community.
So the original took place when?
Bram Stoker wrote Dracula in the late 1800s, so around 1890 is when the story first solidified into the novel that we know as Dracula. So we're looking at the Victorian era, and our production, this script, was written in the late 1920s. So our setting is in the late 1920s, right after World War One has ended, and we're, experiencing the Roaring Twenties and all of the cultural upheaval that has developed at that time.
So this is quite a bit different than most of the Dracula presentations we've seen.
Yes, unless you are a diehard Dracula fan and have followed the thread throughout its entire life, this 1920s version is vastly different from most of the other Draculas you'll see.
That was also a black and white film way back when.
Yes, with the iconic Bela Lugosi originated the production on Broadway.
I remember Frank Langella.
In the film. Yes, exactly. Frank Langella as well in the 70s, which he was also incredible. Every Dracula who has ever played the role has brought something unique and new and exciting and vibrant to it. And indeed, Frank Langella did also perform on Broadway and then in the film adaptation as well with this similar. The script is... It was based on the same script, a few changes here and there, but essentially the same.
And let's go over some of the venues where people will be able to enjoy Dracula. And there's a presentation in Rosendale.
Our first stop.
That's your first stop at Widow Jane Mine. And then there's one in Howland Cultural Center in Beacon, Tarrytown Music Hall in Tarrytown, Stissing Center in Pine Plains, and Milford Theater in Milford, PA. So you folks are really getting around.
We are getting around, yeah.
Yeah. And
we performed in two spaces the last few years, and this year we managed to expand and are excited to showcase this work to these new venues and the communities that surround them.
And for tickets, folks would go to the website.
They can go to our website, www.theateronTheRoad.com. They may also visit the websites for each of the venues.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us. It sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm hoping to get to the one in Milford.
Oh, I would be so delighted to see you there. Absolutely. Milford is an old vaudeville theater, and so it's very fitting. They've renovated and have welcomed us for other productions in the past, and we'll be bringing Dracula for the first time there this year at the end of the month.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Valerie. It was great to talk to you.
Same here.
And thank you so much, Valerie Mancy, for that report. Valerie Mancy, Radio Catskill, culture reporter for Radio Catskill. Thank you. And thank you to all of our guests today. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. I've been sitting in for Tim Bruno. Tim will be back with you tomorrow morning. I want to thank you so much for listening today. Don't forget, we have more local news on the way for you this evening at 6. It is the local edition. And Patricio Rabai will be your host today, bringing you more local news and conversation. That's at 6 o'clock, right after All Things Considered. And before we go this morning, I do want to let you know about a few things. A couple of them are events happening in the community that Radio Catskills holding. But first, just letting you know about some programming changes that are starting here on air starting this Saturday, because Radio Catskills updating our programming. We've consolidated our operations, and this is in response to the permanent elimination of the federal funding that was intended for public media, funding that we were expecting to get. We lost that funding as of today. This is when that funding loss officially hits at the start of quarter four here. These changes to our schedule take place starting this Saturday. They aim to maintain the station's award-winning local, regional, and national coverage while introducing new voices and timely stories. And it's all part of a careful plan to focus on content that delivers the most impact and relevance for the community, especially in this era of reduced federal support. And the new lineup will bring listeners even more stories that spark curiosity, challenge assumptions, and celebrate what makes the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and beyond so vibrant. Our goal moving forward is and will continue to be increasing the amount and the quality of our local informational and news content. Along those lines, highlights of the new schedule include a CatsCast with Brett Berry, award-winning podcast. It'll become a weekly radio show joining our schedule starting this Saturday. Host producer Brett Berry brings listeners stories and conversations rooted in the heart of the Catskills, its culture, history, literature, the arts, and more. Produced by Silver Hollow Audio, and that's starting this Saturday at 11 a.m. And the Capitol Press Room, it's a daily program with the latest insight and analysis from New York State Capitol with host David Lombardo. You may have heard on the local edition, bringing us some clips of his show. Now we're going to hear a show regularly every weekday afternoon at 1, and that's starting on Monday. So that's what's happening on air here at Radio Catskill, so keep an ear out for those changes. And thank you again to everybody that's shown us so much tremendous support since we lost these federal funds. The way the community has been standing up for us has been phenomenal. If you want to join the community, every donation we get now goes towards our upcoming fall fund drive that starts next week. And you can go to wjffradio.org, wjffradio.org. Speaking of next weekend, holiday weekend, We have a couple of events happening in the community. And the first is Double Down on Radio Catskill. So, we're looking for folks in community to double down on Radio Catskill. And this is the official, kickoff of our fall fun drive. And that's happening, next Sunday. That's next Sunday. And that's October 12th. And, that's happening from 2 to 5 up at the Arnold House in Chandelier. So come on out and double down for, public radio there. Again, going from 2 to 5 at the Arnold House. And information for that is up at WJFFradio.org. For now, we're going to get ready to go. We've got On Point coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we go to El Salvador, the country with one of the strictest abortion laws in the world. And there we meet women who had stillborns or miscarriages and were incarcerated as a result.
If you have a miscarriage and go to the public system, they will call the police.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.